Hey there, welcome to Data Democracy. This is a podcast where we explore ways to make data and AI more accessible to everyone. We do this by interviewing experts across industries, asking them how they think about data, what are some of the challenges they face when it comes to data, what's their dream state for AI and data. If they had a magic wand and time and resources were not constraints, what kind of intelligence and models would they wish to have? We've got a great guest today, James Chance. James is an entrepreneur, investor, and a leader in product, data, and strategy. James is the founder of Yourself Online, an AI-driven reputation management software. Yourself Online was acquired by Legal Shield in 2021, which is where I met James. James has also worked at Google and Accenture in the past. James is an alumnus of London Business School and UT Austin. James runs an independent product consulting practice now. If you need help with product, reputation management, small business solutions, or strategy, James is your guy. Give him a shout. James is not only a great leader, he's also a great person. He easily passes the "Hey, I'd love to grab a beer with this guy" test. So let's welcome James.
Hi, Mitzi. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks, James. How are you?
Yeah, doing very well this morning. Doing very well. Looking forward to the holidays.
Awesome. Me too. Let's start with your story. Can you tell us about your journey so far, your background in product and entrepreneurship?
Ooh, where to start? That's a good one. So I've had a sort of fairly traditional and fairly untraditional career at the same time. So my background in undergrad was mechanical engineering. I kind of came out of my undergrad and discovered I actually wanted, you know, I was always sort of more interested in the business side of things, and ever since I was a teenager, I'd really had an interest in entrepreneurship, and you know, pretty much since I can remember, I've always had little business ideas on the go and things like that. So when I was after I came out of doing my undergrad, really wanted to go into something a little bit more entrepreneurial business sort of in the context of undergrad choices. So I ended up going to be a management consultant at Accenture. I took this view because it gave me the opportunity to see lots of different types of businesses in different industries and kind of learn them and really be able to use some of my skills in engineering from more of a quantitative side on these different projects but at the same time be able to see different businesses in different industries and kind of get more of an idea of where I wanted to go from there. So I was at Accenture for about 4 years. Then after that, I'd specialized in retail, and I had spent some time primarily looking with quite a few of the old big box retailers. And it was in the mid 2010s, and I kind of thought, hang on a second, I've spent quite a lot of time working with retailers that aren't really doing so well. What happens if where's the exciting stuff in retail? And it was all really at that time around e-commerce and looking at digital marketing to grow e-commerce brands and retail brands as well, and was fortunate to one of my friends was working at Google, and he knew their retail team, and they were looking for somebody to join that team in the role of an analytical consultant. And what that role was doing was it was working really as the kind of liaison between these big retailers, so the likes of kind of Amazon, eBay, and Google, and being a mix of a partnerships person and also a salesperson, and sort of helping to maintain and grow that relationship. And in my role, I was working alongside the sales folks as an analyst, as effectively like a data analyst, and I was looking at some of the data that Google has, and saying how can we use some of the things that Google, the data that Google has across its products, to help our clients grow their businesses, and then at the same time help Google grow their business. So this was really one of the things I was doing, was kind of taking my knowledge of retail from my consulting days and actually applying kind of more skills in data and sort of data science, and looking at these quite big data sets that Google gathers across things like search, across maps, things like that, and asking, use it to answer questions of what types of customers are interested into what types of products in different geographies, how are those different customer markets growing, contracting, all of those things. I got, over my time, I got a whole load of different kind of different assignments of areas that we were trying to, that Google and these retailers were trying to grow. I got things like, trying to understand even the sort of questions like, what's the market size of women's plus size fashion in Germany? And it's like, okay, if you use all the searches, how much of the searches translates into people buying things, and you can kind of roughly market size. So there were some questions like that. It was good fun. And then I sort of felt after a while, I was sitting in meetings and realizing that my knowledge was kind of, I was sort of running out of knowledge. And I was sitting in meetings with Google, some of the Google management team and some of the clients, and they were talking about stuff that I just really didn't understand, like ROI on advertising, looking at sort of setting a 3-year marketing strategy, looking at setting a 3-year growth strategy, and it went, hang on a second, I think I need to take myself, now's the time to go and do an MBA. Just so I could really get that knowledge and kind of level up a bit more around some of these bigger strategic sort of questions. So I went to do an MBA for 2 years at London Business School and the University of Texas, focused on entrepreneurship and growth businesses whilst I was doing the MBA, and was fortunate when I was there, I came up with the idea for my business, which was Yourself Online, and was fortunate to be kind of hanging out with a good friend of mine who was also then became the co-founder of my business, who I'd met whilst I was at Google, Dimitrios. Shout out to Dimi if you're watching the podcast. He we were sort of talking about some of the things we were seeing, and we were seeing this kind of rise of cancel culture on social media. And also having a few of my friends from the MBA, but also a few of my friends from undergrad that were in serious jobs like lawyers and bankers, getting really concerned about, the image and their online reputation based on their social media posts that were often years old. And we were in a stage sort of towards the late 2010s, like 2017, 2018, where people were being increasingly judged more and more by what they posted a long time ago, even if those things are not illegal or anything like that. It's just, things that were bad moments of judgment coming back to haunt people, and them not getting jobs, or they're not getting they're not getting sales opportunities or jobs or promotions just purely by the basis of what they posted online, in 10 years ago before then. And so that was, we then thought, hang on, there's a problem here. Let's sort of work together and try and see if we can come up with something to solve it. And we came up with the idea for Yourself Online, and Yourself Online was, our vision for Yourself Online was to really help people manage their online reputation or all their online persona, making people aware of what their online persona really is. So being able to kind of, and our first version of the product was really focused around almost a report card of your online reputation, showing the things that are good, showing the things that are bad, highlighting any areas of improvement. And then from that, we developed the product over time to be a more holistic service that helped people to clean up the bad, but then also to grow their online reputation in a way that's positive, so that they could, access opportunities more easily, have a better LinkedIn presence, have guidance around how to build a professional online reputation in a way that gives them access to opportunities. So it's more of an asset rather than a liability.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always thought about yourself online like a friend having your back, you know. it's a really solid product. I've definitely used that. What are some of the challenges you faced when, you know, building company and scaling it? I know it was a really new idea. What did you have to solve for, and were there any challenges?
I think that there were definitely a lot of along the way. With any kind of entrepreneurial venture, there's always things that you think you're going to get, and then there are the things that you don't know you're going to get. You know, the sort of the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. Some of the challenges really were that we found over the course of the company, and when I look back over the total journey from initial kind of concept in about 2018, early 2019, through to the kind of sale of the business to Legal Shield at the end of 2021, we had what almost could be described as three different companies. Because we went through the initial stage of trying to find initial product market fit, which had some challenges around which features we were introducing, trying to make sure that we were really trying to solve for the right thing, and that we weren't overcomplicating our initial product offering. So that was the first one, and then after that, you know, I think then it then became more. Once we had initial product market fit, it was really around scaling and some of the scaling challenges, both from a technological perspective as more people use the product, and from everything from sort of compute through to product quality. As you get more, as the product saw more things, we found we had challenges that way, through to kind of organizational challenges around how we kind of organize ourselves from a people perspective for growth. One of the big takeaways, just thinking back to that early stage that I think might be interesting to some of your listeners, was when we first started with Yourself Online, we had this big vision, and we were kind of like, we want to be the online guardian for professionals, and we want to be the service that helps people that has their back online and you know, help them to be their best self online, which was this really big vision and pitched as big vision. But then when we came to executing it, we tried to do too much from the beginning. And we got into a bit of a challenge, which I think sometimes you can be when you're in the first version of your product, you're at MVP stage, where you're testing too many things at once, and you just don't have the resources to deliver the product to be able to do that. So you end up with a product experience that's, you know, 50% of every feature. So you end up with almost nothing by the end of it, because you can't win on any feature because you're trying to do too much. And we were trying to, you know, and at the same time, we were struggling to deliver those features. And we were also confusing our initial early customers, because we were presenting them with what could have been probably three separate products around, you know, your social media reputation. We were talking to people about their privacy. We were talking to people about their password breaches, which could have been a very good holistic product over time. But we were probably about 5 years too, three years too early on that. When what we ended up doing, and one of the things that was a real, was probably one of the big, you know, aha moments on our journey, was actually killing two-thirds of the product, the early product, and just focusing on that reputation part, focusing on helping people to clean up and improve their social media and professional profiles, and then coming back to, over time, the privacy angle, the other kind of more online, general holistic online pieces. And one of the things that really helped us with this was that we were really, we kind of were looking at, like, what was that, those product features that sort of got that aha response, you know, from from customers where they wanted to really take, you know, get their wallet out of their pocket and go, hang on, where do I pay for this? Versus the other things that were features that people are kind of look at and they go, oh yeah, that's a sort of, that's interesting. Like, it's good to know that, but they're not really, it didn't really evoke much of a reaction.
The world of products is kind of new to me. I guess I've always been in companies with sort of established products where we focused on, you know, sales, marketing, and tech. I recently attended a product workshop and it kind of opened up a whole new world to me. It's like, okay, there's a lot here that I need to learn. Could you please demystify the world of product for us? I know there's a lot of phrases, you know, product, what is product? Product development, product management, design. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
It's a good one, and I'm sort of trying to find an easy way to sum it up. But I think the historical way is a good way of putting it, and a good way of kind of seeing how this product has evolved. Because typically, you're exactly right. You know, in some organizations, you know, generally across all organizations historically, and in some organizations now, you do have this world of, you know, you have a very traditional world of, you know, sales, marketing, IT, operations, etc. And what was happening that was that across those different organizations, there wasn't one person that was really representing what is the voice of the customer, who is representing the customer across these different functions, and who is that in between the customer and the business strategy, that the, you know, the overall business strategy for the company. And product functions have evolved really to knit together the different functions in a way that enhances collaboration to, you know, be more focused on achieving business results, and to also be more focused on the customer and meeting the needs of the customer across the product lifecycle, from sales and marketing right the way through to operations, and even in kind of post customer journey retention as well. Because typically these have been, you know, joined in some cases isolated efforts that meant that there wasn't a holistic kind of person that joining that together, and that has been the role of you know, that's kind of how the product manager role evolved, was in certainly in technology organizations, being the person to join together and represent the, you know, join together these different group of stakeholders in a way that delivers the strategic goals for that product line, and also bears in mind the customer needs and represents the customer throughout those different parts of the organization. Probably within the world of product, you know, you then have a product manager, product strategy, you might have product development, product design, that sit across different parts of the in the way that the product function goes to market. So you have, you know, product strategy that will be very much at the kind of the tip of the arm around thinking about the interface between the wider business and corporate and product, and then, you know, within underneath that you have a product leadership structure of a product leader and product managers that, and as you move down that structure, it becomes more operational, you know, operationalizing the strategy, and then interfacing with those product managers, you know, you'd have people like a product designer who would be working with the product strategy and the voice of the customer and doing those kind of insights and the customer discovery, and then on the other hand, on the other end of the life cycle, you'd have people like product marketing that would say, okay, how do we take the things that we know about the product and take the things that we know about the customer and package that in a way that the marketing organization can embrace to execute in and kind of be that connect between the two.
Yeah, it's so interesting, and I think it's really something that every company needs, a mature product. So I think there needs to be a time where we look into the product and say, okay, can we evolve? Can the product evolve and help the customer's current needs?
Exactly, and it also the progress of organizations towards being more product centric is kind of aligned with their journey to being more customer centric. And when you're looking at, you know, as organizations have kind of moved over time to be more customer centric and showing that focus on the customer achieves better business results in a longer period of over time, the product organization it was sort of brought in as a way to kind of execute that and to really keep that focus in mind. And it is only natural that companies that have been around for a while previously maybe were operating in a operationally focused or a sales and marketing focused type environment, and it is natural that every company will go through an evolution.
Absolutely. I think the world of product is like I said, new to me, and it's super interesting, and I'm learning a lot. How does data come into play in product, you know, everything from product discovery to product delivery?
It's super important. I think there's the favorite, you know, the sort of commonly known anecdote of data trumps opinion. And it's super important for a product organization to be making, you know, data-powered decisions throughout that product lifecycle, and you know, right from almost, you know, starting to engage with customers on a product, and you know, right from the very early days, right the way through to customers leaving a product, there's got to be data measuring. You know, there's got to be measured. You've got to be measuring the right things in a way that is joined up and cohesive across the lifecycle. Some really good examples are that, you know, in terms of, if we go back to thinking about being more focused on the customer, how do we know we're more focused on the customer, and what are the things that are going to tell us whether we're getting this right? It's data, and so it's, you know, it's super super critical.
Absolutely, you talked about data being critical to understand what the customers want. I learned that there's like a consensus among the product leaders that customer feedback is often skewed or biased. Concepts such as vocal minority, selection bias, expectation fallacies are cited. Can you provide some color to this? I've always thought about customer feedback as the end all be all. Hey, the customer said this, so let's go. I do a survey and then customer said this, let's go do that. So it kind of changed my perspective that, hey, maybe customer feedback is only as good as the questions you're asking or the survey you're putting out. So can you talk about how to get customer feedback without really asking them for feedback, I guess?
It's a really good one, and I think we all feel now that we're in a world that, you know, as soon as we do something, whether it's you know, we stay at a hotel, or we go to a restaurant, or we go out to see some culture or something, we always get hit up with feedback surveys. It seems to be a recurring thing that, you know, almost every day I delete the feedback from whatever thing I did yesterday, whether it was going to the grocery store, or, you know, that we get asked for feedback so many times with these surveys that we are moving to a point where the people who probably fill those out are more extreme outliers, where, you know, you either generally you have something bad to say, or you know, you may be the other camp, or you've had such a great experience that it's amazing, and you're really focusing on that explicit feedback that you're gathering is kind of focusing on those tales of your customers, and you don't really know where the middle group is. Although they feedback surveys do provide some indicators, they can't be seen as gospel because of, as you said, you know, there's the challenge around collection, there's the challenge around a survey bias, there's challenges around, you know, making sure that you're getting a representative sample. I think one of the things that is important when you're gathering data from customers is making sure you're gathering both explicit and implicit feedback. So combining those qualitative surveys and other kind of qualitative data gathering, it is very useful to get a pulse check on your customers. It's very useful to see what they're calling out and if they're calling out specific things that you need to take action on in a survey. But making sure you're combining that qualitative feedback with quantitative feedback through measuring the customer journey and measuring the interactions of the customer with your product, and really saying, okay, on, you know, what are the things that I want my the action I want my customers to take, or I need my customers to take, to see whether my business is the product is forming successfully and the business is doing successfully, and how, what proportion of my customer base is actually doing those things, and looking at the customer journey end to end in a way that you can understand which those customers, how are those customers interacting with my business and what across which touch points, and how are they using the product, and then, you know, correlating that information with the customer lifetimes over time and customer outcomes in more of a much bigger picture to really understand, you know, are we doing the right things that make our customers stay longer and improve the health of the business? I think you were doing some fantastic work on that at Legal Shield around really understanding, you know, what are the interactions that customers are doing with the product, and you know, how are they interacting with the service, and how does that actually affect their customer lifetime? And one of the cool things is that when you get into more quantitative data, as I'm sure you found, Millie, is that you really start to understand how do the different types of customers interact with the business, and how can I make sure I'm serving properly the different customer groups I'm getting in the door, and some of that may mean that you have to, you know, embrace some customer groups more. Some customer groups you may say, actually, we're not going to do a good job, we're not going to be able to do the best job serving these customers, so we're going to move away from marketing to them and actually move into other customer segments, or we're going to improve the product to meet the customer's needs.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Oh yeah, our CEO says, hey, do we want to focus on a customer who's born or made, kind of like what you said? Do we want to focus on people who already we know would be good for us, or do we want to change people's minds? Sometimes changing people's minds and trying to get to change their behavior may be harder. Maybe focusing on people who already we know that are a really good fit, maybe a good start, and then evolve into expanding it out depending on what kind of the goals that you have at the moment.
Totally, and we found a very good example of that with yourself online, and when we were building the business, that we found very early on there were some groups of customers even though the product was, you know, the product, we were developing the product and improving the product in time, it was still relatively, it was very early, you know, relatively early on. We found there were some groups of customers that were like, yes, take my money right now. Like, I need this, because one good example is people who are professionals who were applying for jobs in certain industries where they know they're going to get looked up, and that they know that the HR department at the company they're applying for is, know they're going to, you know, check them up with either a background screen or checking just out their social media. Yeah, they were kind of like, right, take my money. And then we knew there were some other customers that maybe could have found the service useful, but they just weren't there at that particular stage in their life and life stage where they were, you know, that they they either would have had to be at a closer life stage to needing the product, or they may have actually maybe needed more education and more, maybe, you know, more education and a broader conversation around why they needed it. And given our resources at the time, we just were thinking, okay, we just got to really focus on the customers that are the types of customers that are really putting their hands up and wanting this right now.
That's a great point. We just have to maybe focus on people who are looking for the exact product we're selling sometimes. And then, you know, when you have resources, go in and go all in on brand awareness and all the other things that needs to happen to
100%
bring them. Yeah, really good point. What is some of the advice you have for somebody who's wanting to get into product first, and then we can go into entrepreneurship? Maybe it goes hand in hand, product and entrepreneurship.
I think we'll a little bit hand in hand, but I'll talk a little bit about product first. I think understanding, for really understanding product, I think spending a bit of time reading about the role of a product manager, and it's quite a unique role, because one of the things that product managers do is they don't generally have very many direct reports, but they have to influence a lot of different parts of an organization, and understanding that, you know, spending some time looking at, there are a number of different books that I will, I've got in the bookshelf behind me, but I'm just thinking off the top of my head, I'll send you some links, and you can put them maybe in your chat afterwards. But really understanding the role of a product manager, and kind of what makes a good product manager, what makes a bad product manager, really thinking about the entire product, you know, doing reading on what that product life cycle looks like, where you know, the different from what's involved between starting a product, starting thinking about a product, through to running it and operating it, and then thinking, that's the sort of more on the functional side, but then on the sort of soft skills side, thinking a little bit about, you know, influencing people, because a lot of the success in the role, and this kind of also applies with entrepreneurship as well, is thinking about how you can kind of influence people and really, you know, be able to affect change, but without having authority over the top of it. And that kind of applies a little bit with entrepreneurship as well, in terms of, you don't have a huge amount of resources, you got to make things happen, and how can you try and make that change happen with limited resources, and also being able to kind of sell yourself to both, you know, your team, your investors, your customers, to sort of make things happen. On the entrepreneurship side, I think, you know, there's so much stuff out there. There's so many things written by so many phenomenal entrepreneurs. They're just, you know, that really the sort of interesting ones that I've read recently, or I'm reading, that could be a bit of interest to your readers. I've been reading this one, which is by Fall in Love with the Problem, Not the Solution, by Uri Levine, who was the co-founder of Waze, that was, you know, acquired by Google. He's a serial entrepreneur, really focusing on understanding the customer and understanding customer needs, and the idea that, you know, you're better off understanding the customer and the problem than having a solution that's looking for a problem, or a hammer that's looking for a nut. You're better off making sure you start with being customer centric. On top of that, other recommendations, you know, there's the classic Eric Ries, Lean Startup, but the one that's particularly relevant for data is a book called Lean Analytics, and it really describes the data that you should measure in a product, and both it's useful for an entrepreneurship, but also for product in general, of how you can take more data-based decisions, what the typical things to measure are for different types of businesses, how you can kind of take an experiment-led approach. I think one of the things that that we discussed a lot in Yourself Online is people talk in product and in digital around A-B testing and, oh, we're just going to A-B test and A-B test. It's hard to A-B test until you think you have an A. And it's when you have a decent A, you can start A-B testing. But until you have a decent A, you have to like experiment and just do these kind of on-off tests where, you know, you don't necessarily A-B test it. You just sort of make it better. Look what happens after a week and go, okay, did that make it work? Okay, no, we go back again. We're gonna, you know, you're in much more, it's not quite A or B, it's a sort of on or off type approach to experimentation and getting data.
Yeah, that's a really good point, especially in startup environment where the product is so new that you're still evolving. Hey, did I break something? No, keep going.
No, all good.
Exactly. What are some of the skills that are transferable across things that you've experienced, like in product, entrepreneurship? You've also been corporate executive. So are there any common skills that if people are trying to move from one to the other, are there transferable skills? Can you talk about that?
So I started a little bit on the kind of functional side, and then a bit more on some sort of soft skills as well. On the functional side, doing data, being comfortable with data-led decision making is something that, you know, I've used all throughout, and getting really comfortable with gathering, understanding what data to measure, finding that data as much as you can, and then using that to then make a decision and saying to yourself, okay, I think this is the situation, this is the hypothesis I want to try and prove, or this is the question I want to answer to know whether I should do X or Y. Let's go gather the data, or let's look at data to see if it supports that or disproves it. That's something I use a lot during, you know, time in consulting, time in tech, time in entrepreneurship, is just that ability to kind of really know, have a feeling of what data you should be, you know, using data to solve a problem, and kind of answer questions and sort of being informed by data. On top of that, I think having a good understanding of kind of broader strategic problem solving as well. So understanding how companies work was always a useful one, and kind of how you can then, based on that, you know, on structure, have a structured way to approach solving a problem. Sort of jumping around a little bit, but you know, building on the data piece, I think a basic understanding of just kind of basic stats tools, like the sort of stuff that you can do in Excel, is super useful to get a feeling of what, where your data is going. And then on sort of above that is that piece I mentioned a little bit before around sort of influencing, understanding. One of the things that I found really valuable on the journey was understanding this concept called social styles, which is understanding, you know, your particular social style and how you interact with other people and how you approach things versus other people's. There's a sort of we used at Google, and also in my consulting days, we used a model called, it was a sort of four quadrant model. Myers-Briggs is similar, but it's a little bit more detailed. And it was one of the things I found really important in terms of thinking about how you interact with other people and how you can make sure that you're, you know, putting yourself across in the best way to other people, was understanding your own social style, and then understanding other people's social styles as well. Because then you really understand how you can work most effectively with other people and kind of do that piece where you can kind of say, you can clearly communicate in a way that other people will relate to of what's in it for them, what's in it for you, why they should do something that you're suggesting, why you should do something that they're suggesting, and kind of just generally be more effective.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, social style can be really effective in any role that, you know, you're in. Now, especially I feel that it really applies in the data world, because you are I mean, I can build all the models, all the intelligence, you know, I can, but if it's not implemented, then I'm just doing it for myself.
100%, and understanding other people's point of view and their style really helps communicating. You know, one example is understanding a little bit whether your audience are more detail-oriented people, or they're people who are, you know, really just interested in the top line executive summary and you know what the results versus the kind of the analysis to get to the results and tailoring the message to get that so that that analysis actually lands with the audience and kind of makes change happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. I really like that you talked about understanding of data as one of the transferable skills across the different things, different roles. How does your relationship with data change with those roles as a product executive versus an entrepreneur? Do you go more into storytelling when you're an entrepreneur, having to pitch an idea backed up with data and sort of things?
Very good question. When I was thinking a little bit about this beforehand, I think, you know, that the biggest one is that you don't, when you're an entrepreneur, you know the data you don't know. And in some cases, you're able, because of that, you're able to make more, slightly more of a, feel more comfortable making a gut in tune's decision. And so really you're happy to operate with, a slightly lower confidence, you know, lower confidence in your data than maybe in a corporate setting, because you understand the in-depth parts of the product, you understand the in-depth part of the customer, and you're a lot closer to it, so you're willing to deal with a higher level of willingness to deal with uncertainty. When I was in a corporate role, you generally would come under potentially more scrutiny in your decision making from, you know, your stakeholders, your management. So actually getting closer to all the numbers you can and using less kind of intuitive decision making was certainly one of those things. I think one of the learnings that between the differences is you're more like, you need, it's a little thinking a lot about audience. When I was doing a stuff online, we were a small team. We all had an in-depth understanding of the product. We then, you know, could communicate data quite freely without necessarily having to understand, you know, bring people on board of what it was, because they all knew the different stages of the product and they knew the things that we were measuring. And it was like, okay, cool. Well, this is where we are now. This is what we're trying to go to. And when you move to a more corporate setting, you know, you're working with stakeholders that maybe work across a bunch of different products, and they don't know what those metrics are, where they've come from or where they were. So you have to really bring people in a corporate setting, you have to bring people along for the journey, and also communicate in different ways so that a broad range of people can understand. Because, you know, you might be presenting something that will have somebody from, you know, I think there's some stereotypes here, but, you know, you can have everyone from people who can really understand the data and they want more detail and more detail, right through to people who really switch off when you show them numbers and they just want the high level kind of high level thing. And that was the thing that was a learning as well, is really thinking a bit about, you know, thinking, understanding the numbers, but also understanding who your audience is. And these are trade-offs as well, because generally, because of that, in an entrepreneurial environment, because you have a much closer team that's much closer to the product, and also you're more comfortable with ambiguity, you can move faster and feel confident in that. Whilst in a corporate setting, you just naturally, by the broader range of people you're working with potentially and their knowledge and their styles, you have to move slightly more slowly, you have to be slightly, you know, and you have to have the detail and have the thinking to be able to kind of compensate for that scenario.
Yeah, like you said, you have to get people to buy in, and that takes time. So it's like moving a large ship versus a boat. I feel like we touched on storytelling a little bit there. I feel it's a very important part of, you know, being a leader. What are your thoughts about it? What's your advice for someone who wants to get better at it? Is there anything apart from, yeah, so go ahead.
I think less is, so two things from probably my experience of pitching yourself online, and that was the most, probably the most relevant, of having to take a story that has data points in it and be able to have this different versions of these stories, whether it's the, you know, 60-second version, the 3-minute pitch in front of a room of strangers, or the half an hour pitch in front of a room of educated investors. You have the different versions of this story. I think the first one is less is more. I think it's very easy to try and put lots of information in there and be like facts, 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 facts. And the reality is that certainly most people, they just tune out after a certain point. And one of the things also is that when you have a point of you've got a point of diminishing returns on information, where if you there'll be a point in the story you're trying to tell, or the point you're trying to put across, or the pitch, where if you cram more detail into it, you actually get to a point where people don't want to engage more, because it's starting to hurt their head, and so their instinctive thing for their brain is just to kind of go, okay, like, I want to make sense of, people's brains want to make sense of this information, and they'll get to the point where they it's just too much for them, and so their natural thing is just to sort of withdraw. So less is more. And then the other one is making the data as much as you can in the story relatable, in a way that sometimes when people, you know, will tell story tell with data, they will put up big numbers, but often individuals, the people at the receiving end of that story, can't make sense of what it means. So being able to put a being able to give a key point, and being able to have some sort of reference point of what that means. So it's a kind of, you know, one example could be, you know, this year our organization lost 5,000 liters of water in our facility. The people might go, oh, I don't know if that's a lot or this or that, but then you might say, well, they lost 5,000 liters of water, which is the same as 2 Olympic sized swimming pools, and people go, oh wow, that's a lot of water. So being able to give people things that they relate to in that story will mean that they can, it just makes it more impactful and makes it more relatable. And then less is more, and really thinking about what's the hierarchy of information you're kind of trying to communicate. And there's a really interesting principle called the Minto principle, which is a pyramid. It's a sort of pyramid, the idea that you can structure information in a pyramid, where you have one main point that has supporting points underneath, and then they have supporting points underneath those. And that's a very good way to be able to make sure you're not putting too much into it, and to make sure it all stacks together.
Yeah, definitely. Less is more is something that I've learned over the years, and Minto principle is great. In my experience, I think I've learned that, you know, I've got so many things I want to say. I'm in the data. I have so much information that I used to just go and blabber all of it, and then kind of lose people midway because, like you said, it's information overload and people are tuning out. So how do you have that one single point in a conversation? That's my main point I want to drive home. And then you don't have to necessarily convey everything all at once. You know, you may have to take it slow, but make sure that the point is effectively communicated. I think it's more for the data folks and listening, right? That's really important. And yeah, less is more. And it's definitely something that I've learned over the years. Speaking of, you know, we were talking about data and how it's being used. You worked at Google, you mentioned, as an analytics consultant. Google is one of the best companies in the AI and data space. What can you tell us about Google's approach to AI and data, and what can we learn from it?
So I have to caveat this response by saying I left in 2017, so it's a little bit out of date now. But I think the ethos of the company, you know, the ethos of the company is probably still remains. And that was they had a really, really strong preference in the organization for self-serve, of actually self-serving your data, and everyone from, you know, whether you're a product manager or you're a sales analyst or you're a sales manager, would be encouraged to run their own data to the best of their abilities. And there would be, you know, there would be tools, you know, from you know, there'd be tools and controls from everyone being able to, you know, that would protect that data from it. You know, some people would have access to product logs and some people had access to rolled up tables in a kind of self-serve UI type thing, but the effect of that meant that it democratized access for data across the organization. It meant that there wasn't necessarily silos, data sitting in silos, or you know, people who were looking to try and, you know, or data being a kind of bottleneck in the process of making decisions in the organization, because the, you know, that for the things that most people would need to do in their job, they'd have access to tools that would be able to give it to them, and would be expected to do that regardless of kind of what level you're at. Admittedly, that there would be, you know, at a director level or a senior director or an MD level, they would have their own dashboards that would be built for them. But, you know, that they wouldn't get a report emailed to them with numbers. They'd go on and they'd look at it and they'd, you know, they'd do that. But And they could be able to double click and go into things if they wanted to. So that was, I think, one of the learnings was when you are able to make sure that data is not siloed and data is not a, you know, we'll make a request to the analytics department and they come back. It's actually being able to say that everyone is expected to, regardless of their job, be able to get this stuff, get their hands on the stuff and actually use it. Was sort of changed the organization, and that also came with transparency as well, which was both from the product data. Naturally, there are controls on this around privacy and around GDPR, and also around some of the data which is just very sensitive that Google handles. But being able more broadly to, within an organization, be able to see the data that a particular team is measuring, to be able to see their objectives against that information, to be able to see their, you know, their KPIs, to be able to see their OKRs as a team, means that you're able to, when you're interfacing with different teams, you're able to go, okay, I'm working with this person in search. Okay, I know that I can look that person's objectives up. I can look at their team's objectives up. I can understand how they're tracking against it, and I can go to them and say, hey, like, I need to land this project. You're working on the same thing in a different market. How about we work together and then we'll both help meet our objectives on it? Because you can see what they're working on and you can see how they're motivated and you can see what how the things they're responsible for, how they're performing, but also how their, you know, their team is performing. It's kind of cool to see that transparency as well as being able to self-serve. And that also comes with, lastly, I think, an education. With education, you shouldn't necessarily force. You've got to realize that your different team members will have different skills, and you know, people that write marketing narratives are not going to be able to necessarily query SQL or do regression models or anything like that. But, you know, there's different people, and at the same time, there's people that are going to want to go deeper than that. But for people's level, they should have appropriate access to training that helps them build skills that help make their job more effective in, you know, up to the limit of their willingness to learn and their willingness to sort of take it in, was one thing. And having a training curriculum and access to training that will take, you know, people everywhere from people who are very, you know, who are not, you know, whose jobs are not super data heavy, but they do need to, you know, they do need to look at data, and they're more, you know, maybe more emotive people, to be able to understand the concepts of data right the way through to training for people that want to do, you know, PhD level stuff, or like deep machine learning and all of that kind of those, you know, really, really deep concepts. And being able to offer training across that spectrum, I think is important.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest challenges as a data person I have, right? How can we democratize data for everybody of all skill levels in data? It's a really solid challenge. And you made a really good point on having transparency on other people's OKRs or other teams' objectives. I think that's really a great point on getting alignment. How can I understand what the other team is doing so that I can align myself to their goals? You know, kind of both of our goals can be aligned and kind of work together. That's really a solid point.
100%. And both the products or the potentially areas of business that the team is responsible for and the team's metrics themselves is important to be able to do both, because you can see sometimes how they relate as well. And having that transparency, I think, really helps people to work together and helps people, you know, be aligned when they're working on these kind of multi-stakeholder, multi-departmental projects.
Absolutely. Again, I think it comes back to your earlier point on how can people work across different teams and not work in silo. And, you know, all the aspects of storytelling, less is more, having greater transparency, all of that plays into this. Let's switch gears to reputation management and AI for a second. I feel that in the era of AI, it's so easy to just ask a question, type a question into ChatGPT, and then it gives you everything. So if I type in, hey, tell me something about James Chance, it'll do the research for me and then pick out all of your quotes from 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And then kind of, I actually tried this, and then it gave me some really good quotes of yours. And kind of, I could also ask it, what is James's thought about data or product management and things like that? And it gave me some good answers. I don't know if it was making it up or if it's your, you know, article somewhere or not, but so the point is, it's so, maybe reputation management is more relevant than ever because you have the best research tools in history accessed by almost everybody. So it's really becomes important to manage your own reputation in the web versus in the past, where people may, if you just kept your social media clean, it may have worked. But going forward, I think with these AI tools, it may be more relevant and more important to have better reputation management. What are your thoughts?
100%. And firstly, I hope ChatGPT hallucinated some good things about me on there. It sounds like it might have done. But I totally agree with you. Previously, we were in an age where if you kept your social media clean and you sort of managed and curated your, you know, first page of Google, you could not really worry about anything that's behind that. And now we're in a world where these tools have the processing power, and these models have the complexity that it's almost like going through, you know, doing a Google search for somebody and reading and synthesizing every single result, or close to every single result. I mean, I don't think we're on every single one yet, but 100%. And then it just becomes, you know, it becomes a slightly different challenge at scale, because then it's really a bit about saying, okay, you know, what do I say now, and what is my online presence now, and what's my online persona now, and does that really align with who I am? And then working back and trying to understand, okay, where is this information coming from, and then what power do I have over it? And the one of the things that is a challenge about providing reputation management at scale is a lot of there are, you know, some, if there is something that is illegal that's about you, you have powers to take it down. If it's something that is defamatory or you know, that is untrue, you have potential abilities to court, you know, have to make requests to Google, make requests to courts, all of that sort of stuff. But that's a pretty hard process to do at scale. So then the question then comes about saying, okay, well, how can we make sure that we're putting the right things about ourselves out there, that we're, you know, that we're really reflecting, you know, making sure that we're reflecting what we want to be seen, you know, our true version of ourselves online, so there isn't anything that necessarily is going to start confusing things. So it has made the process of reputation, you know, management is now it's got monumentally larger as a challenge, and it's interesting to see, you know, how things will evolve over time, especially when you think about how easy it is to generate this information from these AI tools to put out there, and also the unfortunate ability that you're now able to do things like deepfakes as well, and how that affects people's reputation, and being able to call out, actually, is this thing, you know, whether it's text or it's images or video, has this actually been generated by a person, or has this actually been auto-generated and just dropped out there as potentially some sort of defamation campaign? That's when it starts getting really scary. And there is a couple of startups, or actually now they're growing very fast. Was one business called Reality Defender, and it's looking at deepfakes around reputation, and it's looking around deepfakes primarily for companies and also kind of high net worth individuals, media personalities, and looking at things that are out there on people, and actually saying, you know, trying to reverse engineer the image or the video, and trying to understand, is this being generated by a person or an AI? And it's going to be an interesting space to watch for sure.
For sure. It's rapidly evolving and kind of scary at times. What's your advice for individuals to better manage their reputations and digital footprints in the era of AI?
I think the first one is having an understanding yourself of what's out there. So taking the time to Google yourself, taking the time to go back a few pages, and also taking the time to look at the privacy settings on the different web pages that, you know, you come up in. So, for example, you know, the thing I'd really say to somebody is, you know, one, do a Google audit; two, go back to your social media posts, your social media platforms, and make sure that your privacy settings are locked down. Also, potentially think about what's your do you still need that information up there? So one of the things I've done, and you could say that maybe this is because I've worked in reputation management, is actually say, if I don't need that social media page up there, if I don't use Instagram, actually, I'm going to take it down. I'm going to delete it, because it just helps really managing that footprint, and making sure that you're aware of the footprint. You do have the privacy controls on things, that you can, that, you know, you have potentially deleted old profiles, you know, maybe if you had a Flickr account, a Pinterest account, you know, all of these old services, making sure that, you know, that if you have, you deleted them. There are a number of different services that help you get an understanding of what that online footprint is. The Yourself Online Divs, which is now part of ID Shield, will help people give you an understanding of where you appear publicly. So understanding those sites is important. And then beyond that, my last recommendation is having done an audit, done a lockdown, done a cleanup, is think about, are you projecting yourself in the best way? And it doesn't have to be a PR campaign, but just making sure that, you know, you've got your LinkedIn updated, it's a clear bio for yourself, it's putting across where you are right now. If you do something that's interesting in your spare time that you think people might learn about, maybe having a blog page or having, you know, a bio page, and just being thoughtful about what you share, to making sure that, you know, that you're communicating what you want to share on your terms rather than what you might have shared unwittingly over the last decade or two that's being picked up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there is some responsibility on us to kind of go back and, you know, see what we've done in the past and probably clear it out. And like the services you mentioned are definitely helpful. One of our, you know, questions is, what's the dream state for you in terms of AI and data? If you had a magic wand and time and resources weren't constraints, what kind of intelligence tools and models would you have?
Very good, very, very good question. I think that the for me, where I'm thinking about data and the, where we're AI tools now are, is having more, firstly, having more understanding of where things are coming from in the responses you're getting from certainly generative AI tools, just to be able to, because it's one of the things that makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable in having certainty to be able to use some of these tools more, is just having that uncertainty around exactly where the stuff is coming from. I know OpenAI is starting to do more referencing, but I think there's still a long way to go in terms of having accountability in AI. And as these models get used more widely to do more decision-making, making sure that these models are not black boxes is really key to making sure that we're implementing AI in a sustainable way and a way that doesn't disadvantage particular groups of people or you know, confirm biases. And one of the big challenges of the learning corpuses that these LLMs are feeding on is that there's, you know, that some of the material they're feeding from is going to be biased in some way, and making sure that we're not just, you know, feeding the machine this content that then is going to generate more content at the same, so we're just in this kind of, you know, never-ending loop of bad stuff is kind of scary. That I think would be my magic wand, one number one. It's just that accountability and being able to not be in a black box is really there. I think that would be so valuable for the rollout of these tools, the certainty, the general certainty of these tools, and the kind of wide rollout across humanity.
Yeah, that's a solid answer. Yeah, it's again, super rapidly evolving technology, and we don't know how they work exactly. In a lot of ways, nobody knows. So it's kind of important to have those guardrails and understand, you know, how it's doing its thing. Awesome. This was a great conversation. I learned a lot, James. Appreciate your time so much. Thank you. Any last thoughts for our viewers or myself?
I think one of the biggest things I've learned on my kind of journey with entrepreneurship and generally in my kind of business life is just experimenting. Just go out and experiment and you know, think about how you can de-risk decisions for yourself, decisions for starting a business, and I think using data as part of that experiment is really has the key to really deciding what you're going to do next and how you're going to develop your career or how you're going to develop a business or how you're going to grow a business is really key. And not being afraid to experiment is really critical and one of the big things I've learned over my career.